All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So first of all, our shiur tonight is dedicated by Joe and Galia Berry in commemoration of the archetype of Joe's father, Yisrael ben Yosef. We hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, Hashem will have a complete nechama, complete aliyah in the family in nechama. We also dedicate our learning in the zechus of refuah shalima for Tamar Adina Bas Kena Shulamis, in the hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, she will have a complete and enduring refuah. So let's begin. I want to focus on something. I had been ready to do a shiur on Hanukkah tonight, just because Baruch Hashem in the days leading up to Hanukkah. But the truth is, there's an episode in this week's parasha that is exceptionally troubling and difficult to comprehend. There are many episodes or many events in these parashios that are difficult to wrap our head around. But if you take a look at number one, the Torah says the following: Vayichu es ketones Yosef, vayishchatu si'irizim, vayitbulu es haketones badam. So remember again, the Torah tells us the very dramatic episode where the brothers go ahead and sell Yosef, and the brothers again, thinking for, we're not going to get into, we've spoken about many times in the past about why the brothers went ahead and felt compelled to sell Yosef. That's not our topic for this evening. Right now, we'll just take it as a fait accompli that they went ahead and they sold Yosef. They go ahead, they shecht an animal, they dip his coat in blood. They send the coat to Yaakov. Even they say to Yaakov, do you recognize the coat? Is this the coat of your son or not? Vayakira vayomer kisonas bini. Yes, this is the coat of my son. Chayora achalasu. A wild animal must have consumed him. Tarof taraf Yosef. Yosef has been devoured. Vayikra Yaakov simlosav. Yaakov tears his clothing. Vayosem sak bin masnov. He went ahead and he put on sackcloth. Vayis abel albino yomim rabim. And he mourned for his son for many days. Vayakumu kabana b'chobinosav lenachamu. Of his sons and daughters, in this context it means his daughters-in-law, went ahead and tried to console him. Vayima'ein lehisnachim. He refused to be consoled. Vayomer, because he said, ki ered el bini evel sha'ola. I will go down to my son, I will go down to the grave mourning for my son. Vayivch oso aviv. And Yaakov Avinu continuously mourns for Yosef. So the reason why this is an amazing and dramatic episode, besides being a heartbreaking one, is because if you look at number two, the Gemara Maseches Moed Katan says something amazing. The Gemara writes, Al tivku lames ve'al tinadu lo. So the Gemara over here is quoting the pasuk from Yirmiyahu. So if you look, I quote a few of the pasuk in number three. Yirmiyahu Hanavi says, Al tivku lames ve'al tinadu lo. Weep not for the dead, neither bemoan him. So how could Yirmiyahu HaNavi say, don't mourn for the dead? How can you possibly say such a thing like this? Al tivku lames yoser midai. What it means is, don't mourn excessively for the dead. Va'al tinadu lo yoser mikishir. Don't bemoan him more than what is appropriate. What now? The Gemara asks, "Haketzad? What does that mean? How do you go ahead and define what is the appropriate amount of crying? What is the appropriate amount of mourning?" So the Gemara says, "Shlosha yamim lebechi." There are 3 days for crying. Shiva lehesped, 7 days for eulogy. Shloshim legiut letisporis, 30 days in which a mourner does not launder his clothing or get a haircut. Mikan ve'elech amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I atah rachmanim bo yoser mimeni. A very dramatic statement. After 30 days, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you are no more compassionate than I am. Meaning, you have no more rachmanis on the deceased than I do, and therefore stop your mourning. Now, what does this Gemara mean? So first of all, what a strange statement. 3 days for crying and that's it. Seven days from eulogizing and that's it. The take-home message of the Gemara is that even mourning has to have its limitations. Even mourning has to ultimately have its framework. Excessive mourning is forbidden within Judaism. Now again, remember, the Gemara here is talking about external displays of mourning. No one could ever put a cap on the inner turmoil that a person feels. A person experiences tragic loss, that feeling often remains with them for the rest of their lives. It never goes away. It never dissipates. It becomes a fixture of their new reality. What the Gemara here is referring to is external mourning. There has to be a cap, there has to be a limit about how a person chooses to mourn klapei chutz in an external fashion. In fact, well, we'll get more into this. So Why am I bringing this Gemara up? Because in light of this Gemara, Yaakov Avinu's reaction is exceptionally difficult to comprehend. Yaakov Avinu is unconsolable. And by the way, how long does Yaakov Avinu mourn for? 22 years. Yaakov Avinu, and by the way, not just mourning, Yaakov Avinu essentially sits a 22-year Shiva. For 22 years, he stays in the house. Remember again, how do we know this? There is absolutely no dynamic activity recorded about Yaakov Avinu from the time that Yosef is sold until the time that he is found to be alive and the viceroy in Egypt. Why is there nothing? Remember, there's only one piece of information that is shared. What's the one piece of information that's shared? In the beginning of next week's parasha, so Yaakov Avinu tells his sons, there's no food in the house. That's Yaakov Avinu's involvement in the narrative for 22 years. He has one speaking part from the time that Yosef is sold until the time that Yosef is found. His speaking part is, boys, go down to Egypt to purchase wheat because there is nothing left to eat in the home. Yaakov Avinu is one of the avos. He's one of the patriarchs. Yaakov Avinu, in the eyes of many, is considered to be the premier patriarch. Yet for 22 years, he shuts down. For 22 years, no dynamic activity. For 22 years, he retreats into himself. He retreats away from the family. He does not even interact with the children, as Chazal tell us. 22-year Shiva. The question is, how are we to understand his behavior? How are we to understand his behavior in light of this Gemara in number 2? In light of this Gemara number 2, which tells us that excessive mourning is prohibited. Now let's understand this. Why, from a Judaic perspective, is excessive mourning prohibited? So we'll discuss a couple of different reasons for this, but on the most basic level, because, you know, there's a very moving tefillah that mourners say when burying their loved ones, and it's the tefillah of Tzidok HaDin. And the tefillah is essentially encapsulated in the phrase Hashem Nafsan VeHashem Lakach Yehi Shem Hashem Mevorach. Hakadosh Baruch Hu has given. Hakadosh Baruch Hu has taken. Let the name of Hakadosh Baruch Hu be blessed. At a certain point in time, I have to recognize that everything that Hakadosh Baruch Hu does, He does. We could whatever word you want to use. You want to call it for the best, although sometimes that word is hard to comprehend. But we'll call it again as part of a plan. Nothing that the Yibam Shalom does is random. Nothing is haphazard. Everything is part of the design. So at some point in time, a person has to accept the design. Excessive mourning is a rejection, ultimately, of the divine plan. So the question we're going to try to focus on tonight, so it's, why does Yaakov Avinu spend 22 years in Shiva? Why does he spend 22 years in mourning? Is this not a clear violation? A clear violation of the Gemara? I'm sorry?
He wasn't dead. So technically, no.
Oh, so good. We'll get it. We'll discuss. We have a number of answers we'll get into. So take a look at number 3. So the Radak writes the following. So the Mefarshim all struggle to understand what exactly is unfolding over here. How do you understand Yaakov Avinu's behavior? So first of all, the simplest way to understand Yaakov Avinu's behavior is, simplest way?
He's sad.
Okay, good. To the point, good. He's sad. There's a simpler way. You know, it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing that sometimes you see this, by the way, when you see, now unfortunately, it's a generation that is quickly disappearing, but by survivors of the Holocaust, often what happens is, this was documented in actual psychological studies, that they found that sometimes survivors, when they lost a relative, talking about post-war, the reactions to loss were those of amplified or exaggerated grief. Right? Meaning, even losing someone who was older, there would be incredible outpouring and incredible outward displays of emotion. Now again, different people react in different ways to loss. There's a very simple reason for that. Because you're talking about people who lost entire families and never had opportunities to mourn. And very often, again, when they lost relatives in the post-war years, when they were sitting Shiva for one relative, they weren't really sitting Shiva for one person. They were often sitting Shiva for entire families, for entire communities. Yaakov Avinu has a traumatic loss in last week's parasha that he never really had the opportunity to mourn for. Which traumatic loss? The loss of Rachel Imenu. Remember again, the Torah tells us quite explicitly, Rachel Imenu dies baderech. Rachel Imenu dies while the family is traveling. So Yaakov Avinu buries her. Remember again, can't even, you know, remember, everybody discusses why couldn't Yaakov Avinu bury Rachel in Maasa Machpelah. So of course, the famous answer is, because he knew, b'nevuah, that the children were going to pass by the kever. The Ramban says, there's a much simpler reason. Rachel Imenu died in childbirth. There was an incredible, incredible loss of blood. Were he to go ahead and transport her body, it would compromise the dignity of her body. So therefore, in order to go ahead and bury her as quickly as possible, having died in childbirth, he buries her right there, back there. He buries her on the road. And what does he do after he buries her? What does he do? Move on. There's no time. There's no time. Remember again, he doesn't know what's happening with Esav. You know, Esav, they parted ways. But remember again, Yaakov Avinu also told Esav a little bit of a... what's the right word? A story. He told them a story, right? And the story ultimately was, you go to Seir, I'll catch up with you. I'll catch up with you. Yaakov Avinu has no idea what's going to happen with Esav, has no idea what's going to go on. Remember again, he's already been delayed in going home. His mother already passed away. He hopes to get home before his father passes away. There's no time. And by the way, by the time he gets home, what happens? What happens? Yitzchak Avinu passes away. Right? So if you notice again in the last parshios, there's an incredible amount of loss and there's absolutely no time to grieve. This is the first time when Yaakov Avinu has a perceived loss that there's time to reflect on the loss. And so again, I can't tell you, a Mefarish says it, but I feel it in my heart, that when Yaakov Avinu was crying for Yosef, he wasn't just crying for Yosef. He was crying for Rachel, and he was crying for Rivka. Remember, he never makes it back to Rivka's Levaya. Yaakov Avinu never sees his mother again. When he says goodbye to her, at the end of Parshas Toldos, beginning of Parshas Vayetze, when his mother tells him, just go to live by my brother for a few days, you'll come back home and everything will be okay, he never saw his mother again. 22 years he's away from home, and once he's back in Eretz, only a few days from home, Rivka Imenu dies. He's lost his father, he's lost his mother, he's lost his beloved wife. He's lost a lot. Plus the fact that he's lost so much semblance of just normal living. This is not the life he expected. This is not the life that he wanted. So when Yosef dies, this is the first time that Yaakov Avinu has a home. It's the first time that he's settled. And one could only imagine the huge emotional tidal wave that just simply overtakes him. A tidal wave of crippling grief that he cannot overcome. But the Radak has a different approach. Look at number three. The Radak writes, "Vayima'im lehisnachem." He refused to be consoled. Why? Amar Aviv, Shehira bo Aviv avas avala ben ha'oved also. Ki haya imo tamid, ki afapi shaya roem echov, rof pamim haya omidim aviv va'oved also. So Radak says something amazing. Radak says that Yosef was the son who was most often home with his father. Remember again, Yaakov was older already. So as an older man, he wanted someone in the home to be able to help him out. The other boys, who were significantly older than Yosef, were out in the fields tending the flocks, taking care of the sheep. Yosef being one of the younger sons, again, not Binyamin, Yaakov Avinu's relationship with Binyamin is an interesting one as well. Remember again, Binyamin is not the favorite son like Yosef is, for a variety of different reasons, most notably because, remember, Binyamin's life came at the expense of Rachel's. It's a very, very complicated dynamic. He got this child at a loss of his beloved wife. In any event, Radak says, Yosef is the house bacha, right? Yosef is the one who's at home with his father, taking care of his father. Therefore, when Yosef is gone, Yaakov Avinu encounters that void each and every day. Now, is Radak saying that a loss of any other son would be less traumatic? No, the loss of any child is traumatic, Rahman al-Itzlan. But what he's saying over here is, Yosef was always around. Yosef was always in the house. So as Yaakov tried to resume his activities of daily living, there was not one part of daily life that he could go on with without thinking about Yosef. Yosef used to do this. Yosef used to be involved in this. Yosef helped me with this. So the problem, according to the Radak, was to a certain degree he was unable to move on because the absence of Yosef was glaring in every single aspect of his day. Because it was such an acute, and it was such an observable void, therefore he was unable to collect himself and move on. That's Radak. Look at number four. The Kli Yakar has a more esoteric approach. The Kli Yakar is Ma'il Yis Nachim. The Tamo Shel Davar, Sheker HaTanchumin, Hu Kishe Yitein Achai Al Libo, Shezeh HaMeiz Zach Al Rav Tufatzafun LeTzadikim. So the Kli Yakar says something exceptionally profound. He says, you know, we always speak about Nechama. We speak about consolation. So if a person loses a loved one, where does consolation come from? Where does Nechama, the concept of consolation, come from? So the Kli Yakar says, on a simple level, we believe in an afterlife. We believe in Olam Haba. We believe that the Neshama of our loved ones goes to a much better place. A place where there's no difficulty, where there's no adversity, where there's no suffering. A place where they have a proximity to the Shekhinah. A place where they're reunited with all of the other Neshamas. And that's what gives us Nechama. If I believe, that's why, again, you know, the Geshra Chaim of Tukachinsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, has a beautiful two-volume series on Avelus. So the Geshra Chaim says, why do we sit Shiva? He says, if we believe that our loved ones go to a better place, if we believe that they're literally, the neshama's munach mitachas kisya kavod, is literally, again, underneath the throne of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why do we sit Shiva? And he gives a very simple answer. He says, we're not sitting Shiva for the neshama of our loved ones. He says, we sit Shiva for ourselves. For ourselves. Because I'm crushed. Because I'm sad. Because I'm hurting. I have absolute belief that the neshama of my loved one is in a good place, is in a wonderful place. But just because I know they're in a good place doesn't change the fact that I miss them terribly. And I don't know how I'm going to go on. The shiva's for us, says Rav Tukachinsky, not for the neshama. So what happens? So says the Kli Yakar, real neshama, real consolation comes from the knowledge that my loved one is in, if he uses that wording, is in that place. So Rav is in that place of great goodness that is reserved to the righteous. And my loved one has left this dark world and has gone to a world of eternal light. Fine. So what happens? Says Gerak something amazing. Get ready for this. The Yaakov ra'a beruach hakodesh sheyosef eino began Eden. The Kli Yakar says something amazing. Yaakov Avinu had an incredible power of vision and was able to see into Gan Eden as well, into Olam Haba. And what happens? He scans Gan Eden from one end to the other, and who can't he find there? He can't find Yosef. So remember, again, Yaakov Avinu comes to a dreaded conclusion. What's the dreaded conclusion? If Yosef is not in Gan Eden, then what? Then he must, chas v'shalom, be in Gehenna. He must be in that other place. She Yosef eino began Eden. Al king vayima el his nachem. Now remember again, Yaakov Avinu can't fit. He doesn't entertain the possibility, at least consciously, that Yosef is still alive. That possibility doesn't entertain. Because remember again, how could a father ever suspect his sons of colluding to sell their brother, right? Shechting an animal, splattering his blood on his coat to bring it to their father. Whatever, you know, in general, in life, you can only have a frame of reference, or I should say, you can only anticipate those things for which you have a frame of reference. If you have no frame of reference for a particular event, it's very difficult to be able to deal with that particular event. So there's no frame of reference, again, for children doing this to a parent. Yaakov, you know, has absolutely no reason to believe that his sons would be colluding and conspiring against him. So all he could think of is the following. I don't see my precious son in Gan Eden. And if I don't see him in Gan Eden, then Chas V'Shalom, the only other alternative is that he's in that other place. That's why, says the Kli Yakar, Vayima'in lehisnachim, he was inconsolable. Yaakov Avinu says, I could find Nechama over the fact that my beloved son is no longer here. I could find Nechama over that. Because that Nechama comes from the fact that I believe that he's in Gan Eden. But if I look in Gan Eden, and I don't see him in that place, then me'ayin yavo ezri. Then where can my nechama come from? How could I possibly be consoled knowing that my son's neshama, for some reason, is in Gehenna? That's the Kli Yakar. Take a look at number five. So Rashi HaKadosh goes, this is again the third approach. So Rashi says, perhaps one of the most well-known approaches here. Rashi says, vayima'in lehisnachim. Yaakov Avinu refuses to be consoled. Ein adam yachol kabal tanchumin alachai v'savar shemes. So remember again, says Rashi, a person is unable to go ahead and receive. We'll just translate the words, and then we'll explain what it means. A person cannot receive consolation for someone who they think is dead, but is really alive. Sha'al hames nigzera gezera, sheishtachach min halev v'lo alachai. For it is only regarding the dead that God decrees that they will be forgotten, but not upon the living. So what does this mean? Take a look at number 6. There's an amazing Gemara. The Gemara Maseches Pesachim writes the following. Tan Rabbanon. Shlosha dvarim alu b'machshav libaros. There are three things that God contemplated creating. V'im lo alu dinhu shiyalu. And even had God not gone ahead and thought to do it, they still should have been created anyway. What does this mean? So what are the three things? Number one, al hames sheyasriach. So that's actually quite amazing. Shbaruch Hu made it in a way that when people are buried in the ground, ultimately the body decomposes. Why is that important? And Rashi, if you take a look at number 7, says something amazing. Second line, number 7, Sheyasriach, Shem lo kein, hakrovin hayu matznien oso, veroen es tsa'aron tamid lifneim. So Rashi says something amazing. If the body did not decompose, what would people do? Rashi says, what would they do? They would keep the body. They would keep the body of their loved one. And what would happen, says Rashi, V'roen asarin tamilifneyem. And they would see their pain in front of them all of the time. In other words, that if the body would just remain intact, people, of course, would want to hold on to their loved ones. But what would happen? What would happen if you held on to the body? There is an inability, says Rashi, to move on. There is an inability to go ahead and build the next chapter of life when a person still is clinging on to the death of a loved one. That's the one. We're not focusing on that one. I want to draw your attention back to number 6, to the second idea. Va'al hames sheyishtachach min halev. The other thing that God decreed is that the dead should be forgotten from the heart. Now, what does that mean? Anyone who has ever endured traumatic or tragic loss knows you never forget your loved ones. But what does happen? What does happen is over time, when a person endures incredible tragic loss, the first often reflexive reaction to that is, how can I go on? How could I possibly go on with this gaping hole in my life, with this gaping hole in my heart? So the Gemara says, Chesh Baruch Hu made a gzera that meis yishtachach min halev, that the dead is forgotten. Does it literally mean they're forgotten? No. What it means is that a person is able to kind of emotionally recalibrate. The pain is always there. The loss is always there. The void will always be felt. But that emotional recalibration allows a person to be able to move on, to rebuild, and to continue to succeed in life. That is something that the Ribono Shel Olam, he programmed us with this koach. This is the ability, this is the koach, not to forget. Because again, people who endure traumatic and tragic loss never forget. But rather, again, it's the emotional recalibration. I'm able to somehow shift things around on the inside to be able at least to look normal on the outside and somehow figure out a way to move on. Not forget. I don't mean move on like forget, but move on. Continue living, continue building, continue thriving, continue succeeding. So watch this. So according to Rashi, the reason why Yaakov Avinu, on a very simple level, was unable to go ahead and find any level of consolation was why? Because the notion of consolation is tied into this gzera that the dead are quote-unquote forgotten. Understand why I'm using that in quotations? Because Rashi doesn't literally mean forgotten. Gemara doesn't mean forgotten, but again, it's that emotional recalibration. I'm able to push it sometimes from the forefront to just a little bit further back. And that allows me to be able at least to go on, to move on. That's a special mechanism that applies in the dynamic of death. Says Rashi, do you know why Yaakov Avinu was never, and by the way, according to Rashi, that's the definition of Nechama. What does consolation mean? You see, people often think that consolation means feeling better. That's not what Nechama means, because there are things that happen in life from which you never feel better. What Nechama means is the ability to go ahead and dust yourself off, get back up, and continue to live. That's Nechama. According to Rashi, when does Nechama occur? Nechama occurs when there is that emotional recalibration. When that's hames yishtachach min halev. When the loss is not the only thing in my life. The loss is one of the major things in my life, but there are other parts of my life that I learned to focus on as well. So says Rashi, do you know why Yaakov Avinu never had any nechama? Do you know why he never had any consolation? Do you know why he was never able to forget about Yosef? Why? As was mentioned before, why? Because he didn't die, because he was alive. So because he was alive, that death mechanism of emotional recalibration never was able to set in because Yosef was still alive. So ask the Maharal in number 8 a very simple question. He says, Vim Tomar, it's in the right hand paragraph. If that's the case, right after the underlines, Vim Tomar, the Yaakov Hayo Lachshov, Me'acher Shelo Hayo Yachal Lekabel Tanchumin. So the Maharal has something very interesting. So why doesn't Yaakov ever think to himself the following? I'm not feeling any better. There's no nechama, there's no consolation. It's been a week, it's been 2 weeks, it's been 5 years, and I still feel the pain in an as cute of a fashion as I did when Yosef was first, quote-unquote, when Yosef, first quote-unquote, died. So it's asking a very interesting question. Why doesn't Yaakov at some point in time realize that if he's not feeling any, quote-unquote, better, he's not feeling any nechama, there is no emotional recalibration. So what should he begin to think to himself? Maybe he's alive. Maybe, if the innate process for dealing with death is not kicking in for me, maybe that tells me about something about the situation. Maybe Yosef is not dead. Maybe there's something else that's happening over here. So look what the Maharal writes, and this is heartbreaking. He says, "V'ish lomar, devada alameis nigzira gzir shishtachach emenu, aval ein zman kavua umugva lazeh." So the Maharal gives two answers. His first answer is that it's true. There is a gzera. There is a decree that the dead are quote-unquote forgotten. But what doesn't the Gemara give?
A time frame.
The Gemara doesn't say how long it takes. It could take years. And maybe it takes 22 years. Maybe it takes 52 years. Maybe all the Gemara is saying is that some point in time, a person finds the ability to emotionally recalibrate, pick themselves up, and continue on without allowing the loss to be the only thing in their life. So Gemara says that mechanism is there. The Gemara does not tell me how long it takes to access that mechanism. So it's true. Yaakov Avinu wonders to himself, why am I not able to go on? I want to be clear. Yaakov Avinu, from the way you understand the Mefarshim, it's not that Yaakov Avinu actively chose just to shut down. He shut down. It's almost like there was something that was happening to him that to a certain degree was outside of him. So says the Maharal, Yaakov, well, why don't you think to yourself, well, if I'm not feeling any better, if there's no nechama, there's no recalibration, so it must be that maybe Yosef's alive, because says Yaakov, I know that there's any recalibration, I know that there's nechama, but who knows how long it takes. For me, it's only been 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, maybe it takes 30 years. But then the Maharal goes on. He says, V'yeshmi, skip down a little bit. Actually, there are some people where it takes a long time, many years, in order to find some level of consolation. Yaakov Avinu thinks to himself, I can't go ahead and receive any level of consolation because, again, perhaps this is just my emotional disposition. Left-hand paragraph. Look what he writes. Skip down to the underlying lines. Look what the Maharal says. So Yaakov, you know why he felt he had no consolation? You know, there's a piece of this story that very often goes overlooked. Yaakov Avinu did not have one major event that is a linchpin in consolation nechama, which is what? Kvura. Burial. He never had the opportunity to bring his son to burial. Because remember again, in Yaakov Avinu's mind, it's not just that Yosef was killed. Is that Yosef was killed in a horrific way by some type of wild animals. I don't know what happened to his body. I don't know what occurred to him. And I have never even been able to bring my son to burial. There wasn't even a levaya. There wasn't even an opportunity to lay him to rest with my own hands. I never had that option, says Yaakov Avinu. So it's possible that's why I have no kvur. Now again, the Maharal says something amazing. The tamid haya machzir alof. Ulay yimtza eskufo lihios nikbar. Maharal says something amazing. Yaakov Avinu never stopped searching for the remains of Yosef with the hope that perhaps he would one day find the remains and be able to bring Yosef to proper kvura. Ulefichach ksiv vayisabel al bino yomim rabim. That's why the pasuk says ultimately again that he mourned for his son for many days. Yes.
And what were the brothers doing at this whole time?
Shepherding, doing it. Remember again.
Putting on like a good.
Yeah, they're trying their best to comfort their father. Again, understand what happened to the Shvatim is they expected this to go in a very different direction. Their expectation was Yaakov Avinu was going to mourn his son, but then he would get over it. He would get over it. I mean, quote unquote, he would get over it. Baruch Hashem, he's got a lot of other kids. He's got a thriving mishpacha. Yosef is gone, Nebuch, but he'll get over it. They did not expect this. This totally got away from them. The problem is, you know what happens is sometimes when you create an alternate reality for yourself, you become so vested in it that you can't get out of it. So what are they supposed to do now? Their father now has shut down. What are they supposed to do? Go back and say, Dad, we lied to you. So what's going to happen then? What happens to those years of mourning? What happens to all those years that have been lost? That's why, by the way, fast forwarding a little bit, there's like a gaping hole in the narrative of Bereishis. The gaping hole, fast forwarding a little bit, I don't want to ruin the end of the story for you, but you know, Baruch Hashem Yosef's alive, he's okay, he's a viceroy in Egypt, incredible, the family's reunited, beautiful, Yaakov Avinu gets all of his children together, all in Mitzrayim, Yaakov Avinu surrounded by his sons on his deathbed, gives him brachas. There's one piece of the story that is totally left unresolved, that is a major dispute among the Mefarshim, which is what? Did Yaakov ever find out how Yosef got to Egypt? By the way, Yosef, I thought you were dead. Your brothers brought you, right? Your brothers brought your coat to me covered with blood. What happened? So there's a major machlokis among the Mefarshim. But according to the Mefarshim, Yaakov Avinu never asked. He never asked. He didn't ask. You know why he didn't ask? Because he knew Yaakov Avinu had to contend with a certain reality, which is, first of all, he knew the answer was not going to be good. He knew whatever the answer was, it was not going to be good, and he already has an understanding that somehow his sons are implicated in this. Some way, somehow, the Shvatim, the boys were supposed to be good boys, somehow they were involved in this whole Maisa. But it's so much deeper. It's so much deeper. Because do you know what happens when Yaakov finds out that Yosef is alive? You know what really happens? He's just wasted 22 years of his life. He has just sat cocooned in a Shiva home for 22 years over a son who was not dead. Do you understand? You can make up for a lot of things in life. You want to make more money? In Meretz Hashem, you can make more money. Right? You want to go ahead and find new opportunities? There's one thing that you can never make up for in life, and that's lost time. That's a sunk cost. That is irretrievable. The pain, so Yaakov Avinu realizes this, but if you notice again, it's like the topic, every family has that thing that they don't discuss. So this was the topic. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to delve into it. We're just going to leave it as is. So now watch this. So says the Maharal something amazing. Says the Maharal, do you know why Yaakov Avinu cannot be consoled? So he gives two possibilities. Either A, because Yaakov Avinu realizes the dynamic of the Gemara, but he doesn't know how long it'll take. As such, again, he just figures he's going through the normal grieving process. But then the Maharal's second answer is so much more profound. The reason he was unable to stop grieving is because he never had closure. Right? Part, you have to understand something. In Judaism, everything we do is so purposeful and so meaningful. So we know, what's the halacha? The halacha by kvura. We have an interesting idea by kvura. You know, by the nations of the world, right? So if you ever see a non-Jewish cemetery, a non-Jewish funeral. So a non-Jewish funeral, right? You go to the cemetery and what happens? There's a beautiful casket, right? And there's flowers everywhere. And you know what they do with the dirt? You know what they do with the dirt? They cover the dirt. The dirt is covered. You can't see the dirt. Why? Because the goal at the end of the day is to make the funeral as beautiful as possible. How do we bury the dead? We have a plain pine casket. There's a mound of dirt there. And what do? We put in the dirt ourselves. Why? Because Chazal understood, the rabbis understood, that the only way to potentially gain nechama is to first find kavura. closure. And we'll discuss this more in just a greater depth. And part of that closure is a recognition of the reality of the circumstances. This is it. This is it. This is it. I'm burying myself. I'm not hiding anything. I'm not putting flowers anywhere. This is the reality. Says the Maharal, Yaakov Avinu never has closure. He never buries his son. So because he never buries his son, how is he able to go ahead and possibly move on? That's the Maharal. Take a look at number 9. The Sfarno takes it a step further. The Sfarno says, in fact, against something even more dramatic. So Yaakov Avinu refused to be consoled. Now this is amazing. According to the Sfarno, the Lashon of Vayima'ein lehisnachem means he refused to be consoled. He refused to be consoled. So says the Sfarno something amazing. He refused to listen to any words of consolation because he did not want to let go of his pain. Now this Sfarno is very dramatic, because up until now everyone's focusing on the idea that Yaakov Avinu could not be consoled. Does he want to be consoled? Does he want to be consoled? Of course, who doesn't want consolation? According to the Sfarno, Yaakov Avinu makes a conscious decision not to be consoled. Why would Yaakov Avinu make a conscious decision not to be consoled? Take a look at number 9, second line. Vayomer ki eret el bini evel sha'ola, kibel alav avelos l'chol yamav. According to the Sfarno, Yaakov Avinu intentionally accepts upon himself avelos for the rest of his life. I accept, I will hereby be an avel for the rest of my life. Why? Mipnei she'ira hatakala al yado, she'shalach es Yosef el achiv. Why? Because Yaakov Avinu feels responsible. I did this. Now, by the way, whether this means that, according to the Sfarno, that Yaakov Avinu has an intense suspicion that the brothers did something to Yosef, or whether it just means that I sent my young, defenseless son out into the wild, whatever it is, according to the Sfarno, he feels responsible. And because he feels responsible, he is unwilling to part with his pain. I did this. I caused this, and as such, almost as Yaakov Avinu says, I don't deserve consolation. I don't deserve nechama. I don't deserve to feel any better after what I did to my son. So far, if we bring everything together, what we have over here is just a dramatic narrative as to what's happening to Yaakov. And by the way, now you also begin to understand why the Torah is teaching us, why the Torah is including this. The Torah is teaching us about the process of grief. The Torah is teaching us about the process of loss. And as we're going through, the Torah is teaching us how to manage these difficult realities. So again, we see, according to the Radak, Yaakov Avinu won't go ahead. He can't be consoled. Why? Because Yosef was such a fixture in his daily life that literally, again, everything he saw reminded him of Yosef. According to the Kli Yakar, he can't find Yosef's neshama ultimately again in Gan Eden. If he's not in Gan Eden, he must chas v'shalom be in Gehenim. According to Rashi, the Maharal, he can't forget, because that internal mechanism with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us, that ames nishtachach minali, that the dead are quote-unquote forgotten, the ability to reestablish an emotional equilibrium, the ability to go ahead and push loss just a little bit off the front burner, so as to be able to go ahead and continue to live life, Yaakov Avinu could not avail himself of that process because Yosef wasn't dead. According to the Maharal, because he never brought his son to burial. There was absolutely no closure. Because Yaakov Avinu doesn't know how long the Nechama process should take. According to the Sfarno, because Yaakov Avinu feels responsible. Now you understand what according to the Sfarno is happening. According to the Sfarno, Yaakov Avinu spends 22 years punishing himself. It's not that Yaakov Avinu could not be consoled. It's that Yaakov Avinu chose not to be consoled. I did this. I am responsible for this. I don't deserve nechama. But now take a look at number 10. Sir Maurice Lamb has a beautiful, beautiful book called Consolation. You know, everyone knows Rabbi Lamb's book about the Jewish way in death and mourning, right? So that's ultimately, again, that's like part one, where he discusses, again, the process of grieving in Judaism. He has an incredible second volume called Consolation, which is all about, as the title says, consolation. Look what he writes. He says, the loss, accept it, don't fight it. Paragraph A. In bereavement, people experience different levels of acceptance at different points in the process. Acceptance does not imply that we like what has happened, nor does it mean that we forget our loved one. It means that we appreciate the magnitude of what has happened, that we know that our lives will never be the same, that we must learn to live with our loss and to accept the reality of the person who has been lost, both the good and the not so good. To accept means to realize fully that this tragedy has happened to us, unreal as it may seem, that God has decreed it, and that it is utterly irreversible, that no amount of imagination or hope could ever bring the dead back to life, that life has changed forever, that rebelling against that change will be of no avail, and that we must allow the pain of absence to flow through us. Paragraph B. Accepting means that we are willing to relearn reality. It means that we understand that at some point we must end our impossible wish that the person we loved will return. It means being ready to clear psychic space in which to continue to love the deceased on a spiritual level. Paragraph C. As a philosophy for mourners and others, learning to live with pain and frustration, the idea of acceptance can be a powerful healing tool. Affirming death in its full terror can be a surprising source of serenity and an antidote to months, perhaps years, of denying, ignoring, and struggling. Look what he writes in paragraph D. The Bible provides an early example of this dynamic. Jacob, Yaakov, although he rends his clothes to indicate the tear in his heart after the death of Yosef, refuses to fully accept that Yosef has died. He takes the news that his sons bring him as news of a loss, not of an irretrievable death. Since he cannot bring himself to accept Joseph's death, he does not heal. In the biblical narrative, this is all to the good, because Joseph, in fact, is not dead, but alive in Egypt, as Jacob finds out later. But Jacob's lifelong unresolved grieving does demonstrate that there can be no healing without stout-hearted acceptance. Or what Rabbi Lam is positing over here is that the entire message of this story is to learn to accept our losses. And by the way, you understand what we're talking about over here in the world of grief. Grief manifests itself in many different ways. It's true, grief could be over the death of a loved one, but people often experience grief in all different ways. Something I wanted very much in life is not going to come to fruition. The life that I wanted is not going to come to fruition. The dreams that I wanted are not going to come to fruition. How do I deal with loss? Remember, again, there are many different types of loss in life. Loss of a loved one is one type of loss. Loss of dreams, loss of aspirations, loss of opportunities, loss of ability, loss of the life I wanted are all losses that the truth is we all contend with in different ways. Says Rabbi Lam, what the Torah is teaching us is the need for acceptance. Because if we don't, you know, there's an amazing, I think I've quoted this before, there's an amazing halacha in Shulchan Aruch. The halacha, Shulchan Aruch actually codifies that when a person is mourning over a loved one, you know, we often think, what's the most natural reaction to someone who's mourning? The most natural thing to say is, you know, I would give anything to change this. Right? A logical thing, I would give anything to change this. Shulchan Aruch says that a mourner is not permitted to say, I would give anything to change this. Why not? Why not? Well, it's lack of acceptance, and because it's an impossibility. Because you can't change it. And what the mourner needs to do is accept it. I have to accept this is my new, because until I accept it, until I accept this reality, there is no way for me to begin to live again. As long as I'm not accepting my reality, there's no way for me to rebuild. So Rabbi Lam posits that the entire essence of this story is teaching us the destructive nature of non-acceptance of loss. When you don't accept loss in life, you are fundamentally grounded and rooted in the loss, and you are unable to move forward, you're unable to accomplish, you're unable to grow. Look at paragraph E. In the complex notion of acceptance is clearly and profoundly expressed in the well-known prayer attributed to Reinhold Niebuhr. Look, it's actually a beautiful thought. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Such a profound statement, right? We should always try to change the things we can, but we also have to learn to accept the things that we can. Paragraph F. Accepting the unchangeable does not require resignation or refusal to use our talents and abilities to live life to its fullest. Rather, it can liberate us from crippling and counterproductive emotions such as anxiety, fear, guilt, and remorse. This is the test. We need to ask ourselves, is there anything I can do about this problem today? If there is, I will do it. If there isn't, I will accept the predicament and not dissipate my soul and my stamina in senseless struggle. Out of such acceptance comes true serenity. An incredible, incredible insight. So according to Rabbi Lam, the entire take-home message of this episode with Yaakov Avinu is the power of acceptance. How sometimes in life we have to learn that when we encounter irreversible realities, so often again we spend so much emotional energy wishing that life was different, wishing that circumstances were different. And you could spend all of the energy from here until 120 wishing things were different, and what's going to happen? Nothing. It's not going to be different. Sometimes things just are the way they are. What I have to do in those circumstances is accept my new reality. Because once I accept my new reality, I free up all of that emotional energy that up until now was tethered to trying to change my reality, which is an impossibility. And once I free up all of that emotional energy, now I have the ability to go ahead and continue to rebuild and continue to thrive and continue to go forward. Granted, my baggage is always with me. My pain is always with my loss. And again, I can't say enough. This is not just about loss of loved ones. It's not just about loss of life. Everyone walks around with loss in some way. I'm not going to take a poll, but I would venture to say that each and every one of us, if somebody were to ask us, has life turned out exactly as you have planned? I would venture to say the answer for all of us is no. Now, it could be that in Meretz Hashem, maybe for some of us, life has turned out better than we planned. It's halavai, it should be zocha. But I think for many of us, maybe it's not a question of better or worse. It's just a question of different. It's different. No, it did not follow the plan. It did not follow the plan. When I was younger and I had this vision of what my life was going to be like, it did not look the way it was now. And so there are two different ways of reacting to that reality. There are some people that spend their lives lamenting that life did not turn out the way they wanted. Life did not go in the direction, I didn't get what I want, I don't have what I want, I didn't become what I wanted, and so they spend their lives lamenting. And where does all of that lamenting get you? And the answer, of course, is absolutely nowhere. Not only that, by the way, it also turns you into a bitter person, and very often people don't really want to be around you. Because we all know that person, right? That's that person who you ask them how they're doing, right? I just mean it like as a pleasantry. How are you doing? And what happens? You're going to get 30 years of biographical information, right? Well, you know, this happened, and that happened, and this happened. Oh, you give out. I was really just making small talk. I really was just asking you just how you're doing. So people like that ultimately, again, have difficulty forging relationships. Why? Because they're like a dam that's always ready to burst. There's so much frustration. There's so much pain. There's so much anxiety. There's so much hurt. And as soon as somebody like opens the dam a little bit, everything comes out. And just over time, people don't want to be around a person like that. So says Rabbi Lam, we learn from the Avos and the Imos what to do. We also learn from them what not to do under certain circumstances. Here we learn from Yaakov Avinu the need to accept the sometimes compromised circumstances in life. There are times in life where life doesn't go my way. So again, if I could change it, I need to roll up my sleeves, I need to change it. If I can't change it, I need to find the koach to accept it. Because once I accept it, and again, Rabbi Lam is so clear on this, acceptance doesn't mean resignation to some life of mediocrity. Acceptance just means I accept that this is my reality. Then after I accept it, what's the next step? How do I maximize this? This is my reality. It's not the reality of my choosing. It's not what I wanted. It's not what I dreamed about, but it's what I got. And if it's what I've got, then I have to figure out how do I maximize it. But watch this. Turn the page. And with this, we're going to conclude. Take a look. So Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, in his book, Covenant and Conversation, says something absolutely amazing. He says, so look, if you look in paragraph A, about three lines in, so Jacob was forced to find his sons innocent without necessarily trusting what they said. In fact, Jacob did not believe it, and his refusal to be comforted shows that he was unconvinced. So Rabbi Sachs actually takes a different approach. He says, Yaakov Avinu could not be consoled because there was a part of him that was not convinced that Yosef was dead. He continued to hope that Yosef was still alive. That hope was eventually justified. Yosef was still alive, and father and son were ultimately reunited. Paragraph B. Jews are the people who refuse to be comforted because they never gave up hope. Jacob did eventually see Joseph again. Rachel's children did return to the land. Yerushalayim is once again the Jewish home. All the evidence may suggest otherwise. It may seem to signify irretrievable loss, a degree of history that cannot be overturned, a fate that must be accepted. Jews, paragraph C. Jews never believed the evidence because they had something else to set against it. A faith, a trust, an unbreakable hope that proves stronger than historical inevitability. It is not too much to say that Jewish survival was sustained in that hope, and that hope came from a simple or perhaps not so simple phase in the life of Jacob. He refused to be comforted. So Rabbi Sacks says the exact opposite of Rabbi Lam. And Rabbi Sacks says that no. Rabbi Lam, you think that Yaakov's mistake was that he refused to accept. No, Yaakov's koach was that he refused to accept. The great accomplishment of Yaakov Avinu v'ayema'ein lehisnachem means, I do not accept this reality. I refuse to yield to this. I refuse to accept these circumstances as being, it cannot be true. And I know that if I stand my ground long enough, what will happen? What will happen?
I'll prove right.
Things will change. Remember again, even how does the Navi describe Rachel Imenu? Right? The Navi describes Va'ima is also Rachel Imenu also refuses to be consoled. Right? Until the Rebbe Shalom finally has to say to her, Mini kolech mibechi. Right? Stop crying. It's okay. I understand you refuse to be consoled until your children. I'm going to bring your children home. This is the power of this couple. They refuse to yield to the mediocre circumstances. They refuse to yield to ultimately, again, things that fly against the ideals in their life. Yaakov Avinu refuses to accept the fact that Yosef is dead, not because he's burying his head in the sand, but because he refuses to go ahead and give up on the dream. And says Rabbi Sacks, that's the koach of the Jewish people. The ability to remain steadfast in your dreams, the ability to remain steadfast in your life vision, even when the deck is stacked against you. So the obvious question becomes, so who's right? Right? So I'm saying we have two contradictory opinions, two contradictory approaches about how to understand the life and the approach of Yaakov Avinu. You have Rabbi Lam saying that Yaakov Avinu is a test case or a textbook case on what not to do. Torah is teaching us Yaakov Avinu's major mistake was non-acceptance. And because he didn't accept his circumstances, he was unable to accomplish anything for 22 years. Rabbi Sacks telling us, no, Yaakov Avinu is the paradigm. Yaakov Avinu is the paradigm of emunah, of belief. Don't yield to your circumstances. Don't buckle to your circumstances. Stand your ground until you get what you want out of life. So which one is it? And the answer, of course, is it's both. It's both. We have to actualize these different ideas in different circumstances in life. The formulation I would say is, sometimes life is about acceptance, resignation versus resistance, aspiration. Meaning that sometimes in life, depending on what my circumstances are, if I know that it cannot be changed, there are certain realities that we know they are what they are. That's when I have to kind of live according to the Yaakov Avinu of Rabbi Lam. And I have to find the koach to accept. And by accepting, again, I want to be clear. See, acceptance sometimes sounds like a bad word. We sometimes think like acceptance sounds like what word? Synonymous with?
Surrender.
Surrender or? Or settling. Right? I want to tell you something. Settling is a, I don't know how many letters it is. 7, 8 letters? It's an 8-letter word. Never say that word. Because you should never settle for anything in life. Life cannot be a bidi eved. Life has to be a lechatchila. Acceptance does not mean surrender or settling. Acceptance means I need to use, each of us has a reservoir of emotional strength. Just like we have a reservoir of physical strength, there's only so much physical labor I could do in one day, and then I'm just going to fall on my back, I'm just going to be tired. Each of us has a particular reservoir of emotional strength as well. And what we determine in life is how we use that emotional spiritual strength. If I resist irreversible circumstances, I use up, it's like spinning your wheels in the mud. You could use up a whole tank of gas and the car doesn't go anywhere because I'm just spinning my wheels. That's what it means to resist irreversible circumstances. I have to accept it. But acceptance doesn't mean surrender. Acceptance doesn't mean settling. Acceptance doesn't mean, okay, I didn't get what I want, so I guess this is all I could do. No, it'll be whatever it'll be. That's not what it means. It means I accept these are my circumstances. It's true they're not the circumstances I chose, not the circumstances I wanted, but the circumstances I have. And now that I've accepted it, how do I maximize it? It's acceptance in order to maximize. Not acceptance to resign, but acceptance to maximize. When the circumstances are irreversible, that's what I need to do. But there are times in life where, if we're honest with ourselves, we find ourselves in certain circumstances that are not great. And we also know that if we try harder, if we push ourselves more, if we roll up our sleeves just a little bit higher and put in just a little bit more effort, we could change it. In those circumstances, says Rabbi Sacks, we have to hold on to the dreams. In those circumstances, we have to remain steadfast in what we really believe our lives could be and not simply resign ourselves to what our lives are. This is the tension in Parashas Vayeshev. This is the tension in Yaakov Avinu. And this ultimately, again, becomes the tension for us as well. The Ribono Shel Olam gives us such a great gift by telling us this episode. Through the heartbreaking pain of Yaakov Avinu, we are taught how to navigate the heartbreaking situations of life. Whether it's the heartbreak of a loss of a loved one, or it's the heartbreak of a loss of a dream. If the circumstances are irreversible, I have to learn the power of acceptance. But acceptance in order to maximize. But if the circumstances aren't irreversible, if the circumstances are just difficult, but if I put in enough effort, I could change things around, then I have to find the koach, and I have to find the courage to roll up my sleeves, work a little bit harder, and make my life into what it's truly capable of becoming. So we should be zoche meretz Hashem. You know, we these lessons, unfortunately, are exceptionally pertinent to us. These lessons are pertinent to some of us because some of us on personal levels have encountered Yaakov Avinu-like losses. Yaakov Avinu-like losses, losses of children, losses of loved ones. And even if a person doesn't have that personal pain, we've all lost people we love in life. And as a community, clearly, we're in the midst of grappling with so many different losses as well. It's easy sometimes to fall into an abyss of pain. It's easy to fall into an abyss of darkness and not know how to find your way out. But Yaakov Avinu gives us the strategy. Yaakov Avinu, the Torah, gives us the method. The Torah tells us how to deal with all the difficult and tumultuous situations in life. Halavai, we should be zoche meretz Hashem to learn the lessons, but more importantly than learning them, we should be zoche meretz Hashem to internalize them. We should be zoche meretz Hashem to accept when we need to accept, to resist when we need to resist. And halavai, in that zuchus, may we be successful in all of our life endeavors. Wow.